Welcome to the Guffman. I'm Alex, and with me, as per usual, is James. Before we get started, I want to get you to check out our website, as we always do. The
Hi.
MacGuffin. What?
Is that high too late?
Yeah.
Did I miss my window?
Yeah, you missed the window. Our website, themacguffinmen.com. We've talked about a lot of good movies recently: Inherent Vice, Eyes Wide Shut, Sunset Boulevard. Our last podcast was about Dog Day Afternoon and Inside Man. I also wrote a thing about American Sniper and Selma and the way each of them treats the truth. So if you don't get enough Oscar nominee talk in this podcast, then you can get some more there. Also follow us on Twitter at the MacGuffin Men, all one word, no underscores. Subscribe to us on iTunes, the MacGuffin Men, all one word, no underscores. And that's probably about it. So yeah, we'll just get right to it.
Welcome to the MacGuffin Men. And now, here are Alex and James.
All right, James.
Yep, I'm here.
Okay, great. Filling the window.
Yep.
What are we talking about?
We're talking about recent Best Picture loser, Boyhood. A bit of a surprise result, I think, given the Golden Globe Best Picture.
Oh yeah, it did. I was telling people this that I honestly forgot the Oscars were this past Sunday until like the Thursday before, which is very impressive for me because I'm generally good at keeping on top of these things. But I didn't follow the Oscar races that much this year, but I thought it was supposed to be Boyhood, but I guess I'm wrong.
But, guess so.
So it goes.
Yes, but we are talking about a Boyhood, which, despite not winning the Best Picture award from the Academy, is very, very well received. I kind of heard a lot of talk about this movie and people saying they liked it, but I didn't know it has like 100% on Rotten Tomatoes and just has crazy, crazy good aggregate ratings.
Yeah,
yeah.
It's an easy movie to like.
Yeah, how much did you like it?
I'm a big Linklater guy. Like, I mean, put simply, like he took the Before Sunrise formula that I already loved and made it kind of a teen movie. So, you tell me how that worked out for me. You know, like I really like it. It's not his best film by any means, but it's very good. And I think, obviously, I certainly. When the film first came out, before people had seen it, like I saw the first day it was out, and people would be asking me, oh yeah, you just liked it because it was shot over 12 years. So like pretty immediately I started to think about, you know, removing that process from like just pretending that they shot it all in one, you know, a standard 3 month filmmaking process window. If I would like it as much as I did, and just from the script and actual filmmaking choices that they make, and I think one of the highest compliments this film could be given is that even removed from the very interesting aspect of actually making it, I think it's a really interesting movie just to watch.
Right, and I mean you're someone who likes Linklater and likes movies that deal with the theme of time, which
yeah. that's Linklater. That's just his jam.
Yeah, I guess that's true. It's not just this movie for him. Yeah. So, I mean, that makes sense to me that you would like it. Do you think it would be received the way it would without the gimmick? Which I
no,
mean,
no,
might be a derogatory word because you know it's not a cheap gimmick. This was a lot of time put into it and a lot of planning. So I don't mean to denigrate it by calling it a gimmick, but it certainly has a flash to it.
Oh yeah.
How do you think that changes the public perception of it?
Oh, a lot. I think it's much more highly regarded because of that. You know, I don't lie to myself and say that this movie would have been a sensation if it was the way I described it. You know, this theoretical movie that's exactly the same as Boyhood, but shot over the course of 3 months. You know, yeah, no, I mean it's immeasurable how much it helped Boyhood's you know, public appearance, I guess.
Okay, so what did you like about it then so much?
Well, first I want to know if you liked it.
I didn't love it.
Okay,
I found it very frustrating.
Okay.
Most of the time because it certainly had good parts and good elements and good performances, and then there are some, there's just tons of really forgettable, useless stuff in this movie to me. Like, to make a movie over 12 years and cut it down to 2 hours, I think would feel like a waste of your time. But I think this movie just, it stretched out way too much with not enough to say. And, I mean, I've been reading a lot of criticisms. The criticisms I can find of this movie usually say that it's, you know, kind of that. It's kind of just sprawled out, doesn't really have a main conflict, doesn't have a character arc, doesn't have, a story, people would say. And that's really not my whole criticism, because I'm fine with those movies. Like, Synecdoche, New York is literally one of my favorite movies of all time, which is very sprawling and very indirect. But I think just had it all amounted to something. Whereas I kind of just, for a lot of this, it was just separated images put together that never really cohered, to coalesce into anything greater than the sum of its parts.
Okay, I get that. And that is something that I certainly see. The thing that I find the most interesting about this movie is that I do think it has a point. I think that point is interesting in that, I spent a lot of time thinking about the last scene and found it kind of interesting the more I thought about it, and the way you sort of start to piece together the way this movie is actually made, right? They talk a lot, him and Natalie, the dancer that he's hanging out with, while Dalton and the other girl are just yelling things.
Nicole? Yes, because okay. It's another point of this movie that I do not like at all. But anyway, continue.
And I think the thing that I found really interesting about this movie was that, you know, kind of in that moment, I sort of started to think about the movie as, as this kid, as Mason, sitting there and thinking about the things that have happened in his past leading him up to that point. And you sort of start to get this feeling of the movie as, like you said, it's a collection of things that happen. And they talk about the moment sort of, you know, quote unquote, seizing you, which is obviously idiotic dialogue, but they are stoned 18-year-olds, so it makes sense. Yeah. That's a different way of saying that you can't control what you remember. And that's kind of what Boyhood is all about in as far as the things they never address, is that we see all of these things happen in his life, things that, you know, some of them would be memorable no matter who they happen to, you know, and some are just things that you remember for no real reason that you can think of, right? And they just sort of impressed on you in some way. And that's the thing I find the most interesting about Boyhood. And I think a good example of this is early on in the movie when they're moving out of their first house, and his friend Tommy is trying to bike after them to wave hello, right? Or wave goodbye, sorry. The way the shot is framed is kind of the way that would actually happen. You see Tommy through the grass, kind of, and then he's just gone. Like, you barely get a glimpse of him because there are physical things that are in your way. And that's the thing that is always missed in movies, is they always frame the shot you would, so you could see things. Like, there's that exact thing happens in John Tucker Must Die, as a teen movie where that same thing happens. And you get the clear shot of Brittany Snow looking out the back of this car and waving goodbye to people. And, you can see everything that's happening. I mean, she's being ignored. It's a different situation, but still. And what Boyhood does is really focus on these little moments and show them in a way that is more like how you would actually remember them. And I find that very interesting.
Yeah, but I mean, you were saying that kind of at the end, you were thinking of that and looking back on this movie in the way that, his memory has formed this movie for us and the way that our memory is. But did you enjoy sitting through most of this movie, like, while it was happening?
Yes. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, the first hour of it certainly isn't my favorite. When basically once he gets to school and that kid tells him welcome to the suck, that's where I think the movie really starts to get a lot better. But I certainly enjoyed this movie.
Okay, I how about acting wise?
Oh, that's I don't care. Ethan Hawke is amazing in this movie because Ethan Hawke is amazing in every Linklater movie. You know, it's kind of just the way Linklater works. He goes for hiring people that he feels can, that think a lot like him and are willing to sort of work in his process, which is very rehearsal based and are willing to talk about themselves a lot and work themselves into the characters. And that doesn't always translate into the most natural acting. But I mean, you know, you like The Wire too. So it's not like you can make a movie with some unfortunate acting and have it be totally useless, you know.
Is the acting in The Wire really bad?
Oh, there's a lot of suspect acting on The Wire. Have we never talked about this?
I imagine we must have.
Yeah. And the thing is, I don't care about it at all because it's The Wire. Yeah. You know.
Yeah, I like, there are just some scenes in this movie that I thought were just insufferable. Like, so much of the stuff of when it's just kids, when there's no adults on screen, like when they go camping at that house or whatever, and it's just the kids.
That's a notably poor acting moment all around.
Like every kid in that scene, like, and the dialogue was just awful at that point too. Like, and that's what I mean by this movie's frustrating. I thought Ethan Hawke was really good in this too. I thought Patricia Arquette was fantastic in this. You know, playing I don't know. We'll discuss her role as the mother in a bit, I assume. And then I thought there were some really good parts, and then I thought other parts, like, just when something good would happen and the movie would start gaining momentum, I thought we would hit another scene and just screech to a halt. And I think whatever portion of that movie where she's with the alcoholic college professor, that, like, none of that storyline did anything for me, and all of that could be excised. And I just thought they needed to kind of shoot something every year, and then this is what it was. And it was just a really frustrating movie for me because there's a lot of talent involved in making it, and obviously a lot of what work went into it. And sometimes that shows up, and sometimes that kind of naturalistic feel you were talking about works out really, really well. And then I thought it would just go, like, it would lose all that momentum again, and then we'd be starting from scratch. Like, I found it really, 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 really uneven as a movie as a whole.
I would agree that it is uneven.
Okay.
Yeah.
Right. What did you think of Patricia Arquette?
I thought she's good. You know, I wasn't crazy about her, but I thought she was quite good.
Okay. Well, yeah. How do you feel about her as a mother? Like, what? Like in this movie, obviously, not Patricia Arquette's ability to have children.
Well, I mean, I suppose another one of the most interesting things I found about watching this movie was, and in hindsight, it makes sense. I found myself identifying with the parents a lot more than the children. And of course that makes sense because, you know,
you were born a 60-year-old man.
Well, no. And at the beginning of this movie, Ethan Hawke's character is 29, you know, and I'm 28 when I was watching this movie, for the first time. Well, still am, but, it makes sense that I would identify more with the 29-year-old in the movie than the 6-year-old, right? But that was something that I absolutely did not anticipate and found very interesting. As far as Patricia Arquette's motherhood skills, I thought she was fine. I think she was doing the best she could with what she had, yeah. And she's, you know, learning how to be a mother. That's another thing I found interesting about the movie is watching these people more so, I think, with Ethan Hawke, who I'm just going to refer to as Ethan Hawke because it's easier than switching between Mason Sr. and Mason Jr. the whole time. But you really see Ethan Hawke learning how to be a parent after kind of just not doing that for a while when he comes back into the picture. And I think Patricia Arquette, Allison, is that her name?
Olivia.
Olivia? Oh, okay. I thought he calls her Allie at some point. Anyway, doesn't matter. She's a fine mother.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. No, I didn't mean to bring it up to say that she was terrible. I just thought, they didn't make it unrealistic. Like, she wasn't playing super mom. You know what I mean? Like, she.
Yeah, exactly.
There's some moments where it's a little questionable, or obviously she's frustrated, you know, for good reason. What you said about Ethan Hawke kind of learning to parent, you know, that first time we see them, Olivia and Ethan Hawke, Mason Sr., communicating. It's, you know, he's getting criticized for not getting them to do their homework and not eating properly and all that kind of stuff.
Hey, they had more than just French fries, right?
Yeah, I know. I checked at that table too. and then later on, I think Olivia's mother says, like, to his new wife, "You met him at a good time," and it was it was a nice way of putting across, like, they kind of the relationship between Olivia's mother and Mason Sr., and that she probably didn't think he was a terrible person, just, you know, not ready to be a father by the time he impregnated Olivia. And, you know, we don't really see Mason as a guy throughout this movie, just kind of not ready yet. And that's a very Linklaterian thing, is just the timing, right? Like, yeah. He got his stuff together just later down the road. And, you know, maybe Olivia just kind of had the kids and was stuck with them and had to work hard to live her whole life being a mother that whole time. So
yeah, and one of the I find it very interesting how the movie shows Ethan Hawke and Olivia together in the few times that they are together. It's like you said, the first time we see them on screen together, they immediately start arguing. But midway through the film, when I think it's Mason's 15th birthday, when they're picking him up, and they just do a quick hug and then immediately separate from each other. And then the last time we see them together is in the kitchen for Mason's graduation party, which is one of my favorite scenes in the movie, is them talking in the kitchen and just, you know, both saying you did a good job and Olivia saying thank you, that means a lot. And they actually have this kind of like decent normal human conversation, and then it pretty quickly turns into this practical concern about Ethan Hawke saying, "Oh, you did a lot for this party, let me get you some money. Oh, I don't have any money, it's in my new wife's purse, I'll go get it." And even that, like, just clearly annoys Olivia a little bit. And I think you really run the whole, you get everything in that scene. You get them kind of respecting each other and each other's parenting abilities eventually, and being able to coexist for a brief period of time in the same room. And then that time kind of runs up as Ethan Hawke does something so Ethan Hawke-y and annoys you again, you know? And I thought that's a really great scene.
Yeah. And it's, as you said, like, it very quickly shows how they could have, you know, hooked up together, how they could have had something going for a while, but why it didn't work out. And, mm-hmm. Even though they're they still see each other often, they know it's not going to happen. Did he know he had no money in his wallet? Is that the deal? And he was expecting her to just say no?
Oh, I don't know. Okay. I think he was actually going for money.
Okay.
Yeah. I saw, in all situations, I side with Ethan Hawke.
Okay,
but fine. By the way, this is a comparison you might get a kick out of. I think I've realized that Ethan Hawke is my Leonardo DiCaprio. I see all the faults, but it's just, I refuse to hear them.
That's
yeah.
Great.
Yeah.
Even his poor facial hair choices still.
Oh, man. It's so great.
He's got some doozies. I was looking at some pictures throughout the night.
There are just some terrible pictures of Ethan Hawke out there.
Like, as movie posters and covers of movies.
Well, it's like, I think he used to be handsome, and he's just treated himself terribly for his entire life. And one of the things I enjoy about the movie and the 12-year process of the movie is the progression of Ethan Hawke's voice. Like, you can hear him smoking over the years. Like, it's really interesting.
You heard that if Linklater died, he told Ethan Hawke he'd have to finish this movie for him, eh?
I 100% did not hear that.
Isn't that great news?
That's amazing news.
Because, yeah, I mean, they've, as you said, there's that 18-year journey of the, you know, before series. Yeah. And they, by all accounts, are very, very close and respect each other's abilities quite a lot.
So. Oh, yeah, for sure.
Yeah. Did you read about the script of this movie and how it came about?
Yeah, kind of like the before movies do. There's a lot of rehearsal and a lot of rewriting and a lot of actors putting themselves into the film, right? Because I know, yeah. Linklater had the beginning and the ending sorted out before he started the movie, and then kind of they were doing some in the rehearsal process would slowly build over the course of each year.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, he didn't have the ending sorted out even yet. Richard lackluster, if you ask me. But no, you're right. They didn't have a complete script. You know, he had the beginning and the ending pretty much, and kind of a few points throughout. And yeah, he said he even had the final shot in his head for 12 years, pretty much. but basically, they would, you know, they had the script for the first year, then they did that, and then they would watch the footage from the year before, and then kind of start writing the new the dialogue for the next, you know, segment, the next year's filming. Mm-hmm. And you know, as you said, we're very Linklater is very open to contributions from the actors, and you know, having, you know, not just kind of improvising and rehearsing and kind of getting things in their own words, but even to the point where they were putting some of their life experiences into this movie and things that happen. Mm-hmm. And I mean, during the 12 years, Ethan Hawke and Patricia Arquette both actually had divorces and remarried and had another kid. So I can imagine that there are probably just some specifics in this movie that relate to the time that they had in between. But I thought that was fascinating.
Yeah, absolutely. I think one of the, you know, one of the best points to showing Linklater's process is Before Sunset. Like, they did the same thing on Before Sunrise, but Before Sunset, Ethan Hawke and Julie Delpy are actually credited writers with Linklater. And the movie in Before Sunset, Jesse, Ethan Hawke's character, talks about his marriage, and it really sounds like somebody that's about to have a divorce. And in real life, about 5 months later, Uma Thurman and Ethan Hawke got divorced after that movie came out. And it's just, that's the way Linklater makes movies, is that they sit in a room and talk about what's actually going on in their lives. And yeah, that sort of turns into the script.
Yeah. And speaking of that, speaking of his divorce with Uma Thurman, the Black Album, that Beatles CD that he gives Mason in this movie, he gave to his daughter to help deal with the falling apart of that marriage, mm-hmm. which I thought was very, very interesting as well. Like that's like the other half of that story. You know what I mean? Yeah. Like that, this was leading up to it. And then this is kind of shows some of the aftermath of it.
Yeah. And that actually got, well, sort of a seemingly slightly rewritten version, because it's addressed to Mason, got published on BuzzFeed in the fall, the thing that Ethan Hawke wrote. And it's actually a nice little piece of music criticism. So yeah, you can check that out if you like. And it's also the most Ethan Hawke-iest thing that has ever existed when you read it.
So. It has a shitty mustache?
Yeah, it has a shitty mustache. And there's, even though it was an internet exclusive, there's still cigarette ashes all over it. I never understood it.
And parts of the article are written really poorly, but you'll defend it.
Yeah, exactly.
Pure Ethan Hawke, man. Yeah. Hey, we have IFC to thank for this film, eh?
Yeah, shout outs to IFC.
What up, IFC? I like bringing them up just because it's like this whole project is so interesting. Like for me, the process is much more interesting than the results, but I have a ton of respect for like this project and the people involved for it, with it, just because of what a gamble it was, you know, how much time and work was put into it. And it just for Linklater, like this obviously took up a big part of his life, or over a big part of his life. But it's you could tell this is just such a meaningful project for him. And, you know, just the way he puts a lot of his life into it. Like, oh, another thing was both he and Ethan Hawke's dads were, you know, I think left them when they were young and were both Texas insurance salesmen as mm-hmm. well.
Yep.
So another thing there to show how close those guys are and how much of their real life is in this movie as well. Mm-hmm. But did you see the deal he made for this movie, Linklater?
Was it just a certain amount of money up front so that they could make sure they covered the little bit of costs every year? I don't know.
Oh, no. He, I think he just kind of like completely passed over like the initial director's fee. Like usually it's a combination of your fee and then some points. I think for this one, it's like it was all points and he still owns the product pretty much. And he can sell it off to the library, like things like that. Yeah, it's something he actually still owns it because of the deal that they struck, instead of him just getting money up front, he gets a lot of it on the back end, which is very good for him, considering this movie made like $45 million on a $2 million budget or something.
Yeah, I think the budget's four. But,
yeah. Okay, yeah. Yeah, you're right. Yeah, I guess they said they basically shot $200,000 worth of budget like per year for mm-hmm. this 12-year period. And then that's only 2.4. And then I guess the 1.6 would be the other things involved with post-production and marketing and things like that. But
marketing's never included in film budgets.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Well, then I guess like Linklater is just very happy this made as much money as it did, and has he still will continue to make a lot of money from this, and you know, the home video rights and all that kind of stuff. So good mm-hmm. for him.
Yeah,
it's just cool, like, for someone to take a big gamble on something, you know, to what I consider to be a very I don't know, bold and like just a very interesting project about making good film and just doing it very real and doing it with the cooperation of your actors and things like this. I'm not nuts about this movie, but I'm very happy it got made and very happy it is being as successful as it is.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, we talked about this with Spike Lee last week, how there are some directors that I just want to get $20 million every year to be able to make a movie. And Linklater is one of those. Similarly to Spike Lee, I find Linklater has a pretty spotty filmography, but just his voice is very, very good to have a part of culture.
Yeah. And I think when things fail, they fail, you know, for the right reasons with those guys, like they're being ambitious and things like that.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. They're at least trying something that doesn't, at least for the most part, they're trying something that, like, The Bad News Bears, you know, that's a movie that Linklater made that somebody else could have made, but and it failed. But, you know, there's always something in the vast majority of their movies that is just unique, you know, and I like that.
Yeah. So I guess they had to shoot pretty much 1 week a year every year. Like, you would mm-hmm. get the crew and all the actors together. Yeah, that must just be a crazy experience. Like, I was just making a movie in this way. It's so insane to me. Yeah. Listening to Ethan Hawke talk about it, he said it's like human time-lapse photography. Mm-hmm. And he, you know, he was talking about what we were talking about earlier of doing Boyhood with just different actors and more makeup and doing it in that, you know, a normal 3-month window. And he said just imagining his relationship with the L.R. Coltrane, the one who played Mason Jr. Mm-hmm. You know, to have him do lines 12 years after the first time you met him and doing all these lines, you know, about being a little kid and stuff, must be just so insane.
Yeah, for sure. And I know I mentioned this to you, but there were these behind the scenes photos that came out probably around December, I think in the New York Times online. But there was just, you know, a couple pictures from every year. And if you were just looking at the t-shirts that the crew were wearing, I mean, Boyhood was shot in Texas. And over the past decade, there's been a lot of Texas football productions that have been made. And you could see the same crew member over the course of three shots goes from wearing the Friday Night Lights movie t-shirt to the Friday Night Lights TV show t-shirt to the Where the Game Stands Tall t-shirt, which is that Jim Caviezel football movie that came out last year. And there are like five or six people in this movie that are in Friday Night Lights. It's a very Texas movie. Yeah,
it is very much so.
Even aside from, you know, being set in Texas and people talking about Texas all the time.
Yeah, and on that note, Linklater was talking about the home video version of this. And he said that they just have tons of behind the scenes stuff because everyone had digital cameras. I mean, they started filming in 2002, which, I mean, seems like a while now, but people still digital cameras, and mm-hmm. soon everyone had their cell phone with a camera on it too. So he said that there's like really good interviews with you know, L.R. Coltrane in the first year when he's like 7 years old, and I mean, he must, like, you don't even remember so much stuff from when you're 6 or 7 years old, that to kind of, for him to see himself in all this kind of stuff, I think will be really interesting. But he said there's just going to be tons of that stuff on the Blu-ray or DVD. So for people like you who really like this movie and the concept of time, mm-hmm. right up your alley.
Well, I suspect I wouldn't watch a lot of that. I don't watch a lot of behind the scenes stuff anymore, unless it's on the actual production. But, and I also, I don't, anticipate watching this movie a lot of times over the course of my life. It's a very good one view, I find. And then after that, not so much.
I found it to be a very good, like, 0.66% mm-hmm. view. Mm-hmm. Yeah. What does this movie say about alcohol and drugs? That's a question you've been asking me in a lot of movies lately, and then this one really, really threw me for a loop.
Well, that's another thing I like about this movie, right? That they're... I'm just going to accidentally frequently refer to this movie as a teen movie, even though it's only half a teen movie, but there are so many moments in this movie where... you know, the cue that you get from every other movie, say when Ethan Hawke's telling Mason not to text while he's driving on his way up to Austin or whatever for the weekend. You're like, oh, we're going to see texting and driving, and then something bad is going to happen.
And then I know, we see, and then he then looks at that pig.
Yeah, and then nothing bad happens. And there are so many...
Yeah, that the sorry, but the camping scene where they're all drinking with the seniors and just like throwing blades at each other and like, hold this in front of your face, I'm gonna punch it. Like, yeah. And nothing ever comes of it.
Yeah, and I love that because like I think it's this wonderful comment on how we've been conditioned to treat films. Like, I mean, The Duff is the most recent teen movie to come out, and you watch that and you get the setup at the beginning of the scene, and then the second somebody says that line, like, don't be texting and driving, you're like, oh, somebody's gonna text and drive and something bad's gonna happen. And that's what would happen in The Duff, but in or in pretty much any other teen movie. And in Boyhood, that happens, and it's just like, yeah, sure, dad, and then, you know, nothing bad happens. And it's just it's just a thing you do anyway, and sometimes it goes wrong, and in this movie it doesn't. You know, and there are tons of moments in this movie where things that happen in a teen movie happen in this movie and just happen slightly differently. There's no like there's no Keenan Ivory Wayans popping in the background yelling message, you know. And like even just even down to the tiny fact that when they're at that party that Mason's friend's band is playing, they're drinking out of clear solo cups and not red solo cups.
You know? Yeah, what's going on?
When they're looking at porn and don't get caught, all these things. And I think there are some... another one of my favorite scenes in this movie is when Mason and whatever that girl's name that's on the bike, when he's walking to...
Yep.
After Samantha doesn't pick him up. When they talk about suicide, that's one of my favorite scenes in the movie because it's how 15-year-olds talk about suicide. And, you know, I mean, certainly I've... from personal experience know that that is what happens, and I had never seen that in a movie before, and I felt like that was really fascinating. And if this movie had nothing else to it, if this movie was 2 hours and 45 minutes and the only 5 minutes I cared about was that, I think this movie would still have worth, because I thought that was fascinating.
Yeah, it's kind of like you receive so many warnings from your parents and from adults as a kid, and you know, obviously some of it's good advice, but so much of it never comes to pass. Like the thing they're warning you about never comes to pass, right?
Yeah.
And I mean, there's a few times in this movie where it looks like it's about to happen. I mean, they make that joke about is it Samantha? Yeah, Samantha. Little Linklater. I didn't know that.
Yeah.
I have something to say about her too. But you know, they make the joke that she's pregnant at one point, and you're like, oh, they, you know, they had that set up and now this is paying off, because there's that conversation about using protection earlier with mm-hmm. Which I thought was actually a really nice scene.
Oh, that seems one of like the moment where Ethan Hawke says, you have a boyfriend, like this like question slash realization, like that whole scene is great, and that's a really great Ethan Hawke moment. And yeah, just that scene in general is really wonderful.
Yeah, that seems nice. But you know, that's kind of that thing we were saying. Like, they set it up, and same with, as you mentioned, when they're looking at porn and don't get caught. Like, we get them looking at porn, and then we get the shot from, like, outside of the door opening, and you're like, oh, well, this is it, of course. Like, mm-hmm. It's another time. But yeah, Chekhov.
Sorry?
Chekhov? Must be spinning in his grave.
Yeah.
Chekhov's gun is not fired in this entire movie, I promise you. It just doesn't happen.
Chekhov's flask of vodka definitely gets drank while in a car, but nothing bad comes of it.
Yeah, so can we talk more about the drugs and alcohol in this movie?
Sure.
Is there a consistent message about drugs and alcohol? I mean, we have our angry dad who throws a glass of something at his kid.
It's the empty glass that used to have bourbon in it.
Oh, okay. Was that bourbon?
It looked like Maker's Mark.
That's true. That is that shape. Anyway, that whole part of the movie sucked. We have that. We kind of get alcohol as a really bad thing there. And then...
That guy's the doctor in Varsity Blues, by the way. I feel like you'd get a kick out of that. Another Texas football production.
I read his Wikipedia. He's a huge Texas guy. It says he's an actor in movies that are shot in Texas. I don't think he leaves the state. It's amazing.
No, I think there's, like what I said with the Friday Night Lights people, it was shot in Austin, like a lot of this movie. And it's just, you know, how you get a lot of Baltimore actors in The Wire, which we previously brought up. It's just a thing. Anyway, continue.
That's awesome. It looks like we have alcohol is really bad. And then I think alcohol and Mason Sr. His drinking is a lot more present when he's younger and seemingly, you know, not living his life properly, I guess, is what the movie's trying to say. Mm-hmm. And then we have Mason Jr. drinking a lot and his friend drinking a lot and driving. But then when they get offered alcohol, they always say no. Like, Mason's drug and alcohol use is very confusing to me. And he seems to be doing a lot of it, except when it's acceptable. Is the whole rebellion nature of drugs and alcohol for teenagers?
The only time I can think of Mason turning down alcohol is that scene, Ethan Hawke's last scene. Which is a scene that I think makes sense. You know, it's when you're 18, your dad offers you a beer. It's a weird trap. You know, I understand the hesitance there. But is there any other scene that you can think of where he turns down beer?
I thought there was one other one.
Mm-hmm. Well, there's that kid in that your beloved buzzsaw scene where they're throwing shit at the. But that kid turns down a beer. Mason doesn't turn down a beer in that scene.
Right. Maybe that's what I was thinking.
Yeah.
He's super open to just eating things his druggy roommates give him.
Dalton looks like a trustworthy guy. Anybody with hair like that is trustworthy, right?
Dalton looks like my favorite part of this movie. It's fantastic.
Such a goof. Even just his walk is so silly.
Everything. I was like, do you have an accent? Are you just speaking weirdly? What's happening here?
He's a stoned 18-year-old. That's the accent.
I guess so. Mm-hmm. And somewhere said that they were eating mushrooms when they were eating that chocolate, like infused into it. And I thought it would just be weed brownies or something. But
Dalton has a poster of mushrooms on his wall, by the way.
I saw that. Yeah. But, what about, drugs and alcohol we talked about. What about religion? I thought this movie had a very kind of half-baked idea about religion as well.
I think it's the same with alcohol. I think it's that it's something that's there and it's a part of life and there are different ways to consume it, I suppose. And there are different ways to treat it and some are more problematic than others. I think this movie obviously deals a lot more with alcohol than it does with religion. But I think it's just sort of a Southern America sort of thing, like a rural sort of thing where, in some places it's not that insane to drink and drive, you know?
We have mentioned Varsity Blues already, so.
And just the way that, you know, laws are laws, but the way society actually reacts to these laws change depending on the area that you're actually in, right? And it's kind of the same with religion, you know. And Texas is still a very religious state, and it makes sense that Mason Jr. could have a stepmom that is a true believer, I suppose, and still not care about religion at all, right?
Yeah, does he not? We're not meant to believe he found God. He just found someone who has found God.
Oh, Mason Sr.? Yes, I think I think it's a playing along sort of thing. Because it's just one of the many things that he disagrees with his second wife on, but he loves her enough to let it go.
Okay. Yeah, yeah. I wasn't sure. I thought we were gonna.
Just like he loved her enough to stop smoking weed with Jimmy all the time. Yeah.
Yeah, I guess. And actually, that's perfect because that is my next question. What do we make of that guy? Because, you know, especially near the end, and near the middle to end, we get something that I thought we would get in Boyhood, in a movie about, you know, childhood and teenage years and ending up when you're on your way to college, was a lot of the, you know, what are you going to make of yourself? If you're going to have ambition, are you going to apply yourself? You're going to find your right people, that kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. You know, it seemed very much, and every one of Mason's dads, other than his real dad throughout this movie, you know, talks to him about following the rules and, you know, being grateful and, you know, having ambition and doing something with your life. And then we kind of got, when we meet Jimmy and he's with, you know, Mason Sr., I think we kind of get the bohemian, these guys just, you know, smoke weed and drink and want to make music, but are never going to make it big and should get their lives together kind of stuff. And then in the end, you know, as the Masons are having a conversation about applying yourself and your future, we kind of get Jimmy being, he looks somewhat successful. I mean, like, he seems happy. He's got this show. He still has his friends. He seems to be enjoying the way he's making his livelihood. I just didn't want to know what you thought of what we were supposed to take from that character.
I think it's just another one of those, well, there are many ways through life sort of things that Linklater likes so much. I mean, I think there's a lot more ambiguity to Jimmy than, you know, he's just a successful guy. He's clearly still a musician. That is inarguable. He's holding a guitar in his last scene.
He's what?
Holding a guitar in his last scene.
Yeah.
But I don't think he's necessarily like, you know, and there are certainly different levels of success as a musician. This is not a tiny place that he's playing. We don't know that he's the headliner. He might just be opening and he might be going back to that same apartment that he used to live in with Mason Sr., right? So I don't think we get enough definitive answers about Jimmy to really say that he necessarily has a good life. He certainly seems like a happy person every time we see him. But you can be a happy failure, you know? And I think that's kind
of... all those Bob Dylan paintings.
And I think that's one of the points of Jimmy, is that, you know, he might be a failure or he might not be, but he's definitely happy. And that's what you're supposed to take away, you know, I think.
Right. And it's...
Or at least he's more happy than sad.
Yeah. And I mean, we get a lot of... just because of Mason being who he is as a character, I mean, he's... the photographer, he's artistic, he seems sensitive, he doesn't seem sheeple, I think is the word you could use. And you know, it seems like he is someone who is not going to probably fight in Iraq or Afghanistan, wherever one of Mason's mother's at time partners did. You know, he doesn't seem like the jock guy. And so he's kind of being handled like, okay, you're going to have a future, but you know what I'm trying to say? Like, he's going to have a different future. He's going to have a future that might be a bit more like Mason Sr.'s, or might be more like Jimmy's, where he's, you know, kind of doing his own thing and being artistic. And, that still is a path, you know, that still is a way to happiness, as we kind of see with Jimmy. Is that the point?
Well, I think it's another path. I don't think there are any definitive statements made about where Mason's going to be in 10 years. I don't think the movie wants to.
I think you're right.
Yeah, and all throughout the movie, he sees all of these different options for himself, right? And you're correct that Jimmy is one of them. But I mean, again, if you think back to when you're 18, you know, and what you expected your life would be, or at least in my perspective, I could not have called what I'm currently doing, not only because, you know, podcasting didn't exist 10 years ago, but...
But Boyhood is being filmed.
Yeah, exactly. But yeah, Boyhood 2 is just 12 years of Mason making a podcast. But I mean, if you asked me where I'd be in 10 years as an 18-year-old, I would have been wrong, you know? Like, and I think that's where the movie's supposed to leave us, is that he's got all of these memories, he's got all of these ideas of how people live their lives, and now he's at the point where he gets to choose how to live his life going forward, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, very... open-ended finish, I guess.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Oh, well, I'll talk about Nicole now.
Okay.
So, because I sounded like I had a huge point. It's not huge. It sounded like I had this huge history about this actress or something, and it's like one point. Do you remember when, whatever, drunk professor dad gets Mason to shave his head.
I do.
Okay. And then he gets sent to school and he's all worried about his short haircut and he gets a note from that girl.
Yep.
And it says, I think your hair is cute or I like your hair or something.
Yep.
And she signs it Nicole.
Mm.
And then they leave the school. And I kind of thought about that scene, or they move again and they change schools. And I kind of thought about that scene when they were arguing about moving. And it was something like I made a note about it at the time. And I was just like, we better not see Nicole again because I didn't move as a kid. I always felt bad, really bad for kids who did move all the time and kind of like that having to make new friends and having to leave old friends all the time. That part, like I was very true. Like there was this thing, you had this thing, something was good and then you move and it's gone. And that's how life works. Sometimes things change and they never ever come back. And it crossed my mind that she would come back from the movie. And I was like, no, that would be so, so ridiculous and so hack and so silly and so out of tone with the naturalistic stuff that happens in this movie. And then, you know, we're almost out of this movie. And then it's this cute girl who's getting along with and her name's Nicole. Now, I don't know if it's the same Nicole, I'm upset. Mm-hmm. if it's a different Nicole, it just bugs me a bit. Like, it just bugs me that he's trying to have it both ways. Like, it's this chance for things to come back. And I know you always get another chance in life. And when things go away, like, that's what opens the door for all these new things to happen. But there's something about just the interchangeability of females for him to find that bugged me a lot. And yeah, that was one thing that left a bit of a sour taste in my mouth with this movie.
Okay, fair enough.
But that really, I did not like that at all. I'm surprised you're as happy with the ending as you are.
I think a big part of it has to do with the fact that they're stoned. Otherwise, I would find that conversation insufferable.
And that they don't kiss?
Oh, I don't care about that. Well, really? Obviously, I like that they don't. I would care much more in like a negative way if they did kiss, of course. Anybody that has listened to three episodes of this podcast is probably aware of that.
You don't want people to get together romantically
ever. No, be a lone wolf, man. And I think it's without that, without me sort of starting to think about this movie as a guy reflecting on his memories, I think this movie's much weaker, you know. And and I like that weird sort of space that the movie leaves you in, and because it doesn't have a definitive answer. And one thing I found the most interesting about watching this movie was just sort of threw on various songs from the soundtrack onto my iPod after I saw it, just to sort of have them. And that song that plays when he leaves for college, it's Hero by Family of the Year, is a song I would hate in any other situation. I really would not like that song. Yeah. And it just sort of showed up and started playing while I was grocery shopping. And I was just like immediately thinking about all these things in the movie that I found interesting. And then immediately thinking about all these things in my life that this movie made me think of that I also found interesting. And then also thinking about Before Sunset, because there's a conversation early in that movie where Jesse explains how he wants to write a book that takes place in the span of a pop song. And then he's just sort of reflecting back on his own life, right? And I always hated that scene in Before Sunset, which is one of my favorite movies ever. And because it just sounded like the type of book Ethan Hawke would write, you know? And I was just like, ugh, this. You know, it's this moment of silliness in this otherwise perfect movie that is now 10 years old that I'm now thinking about and now don't think is stupid because I'm now reflecting on this thing differently. And it was just all these... It was the weirdest fucking thing to happen to me while I've ever been buying baby carrots, you know? Like, it's just... It's so bizarre. And I think that's sort of the enduring thing about Richard Linklater movies that makes me like him so much is that and this movie, despite, you know, I think it has many faults. I think I certainly like it more than you do, but I don't like it as much as the average person.
Not as much as Christopher Nolan or Barack Obama, who said it's the best movie of the year.
Barack Obama and Christopher Nolan both did that?
Yep.
Huh, that's interesting.
Not at the same time. Well, maybe. Odds are not, though.
Odds are not, yes, that's correct. it's just sort of this there's just something about Linklater movies that stick with me, or the Linklater movies that are really made in this style, like the before movies and this, that just sort of stick with me and jump into my head at any given time. And that's sort of, that's how I like to define really great movies, is not the movie that, you know, I see and I'm like, that's the best movie I've ever seen. It's the movie I think about 3 weeks later for no reason. You know, it just sort of, it just happens. I'm not trying to think about it for a podcast. I just think about it, you know, and Linklater is good at creating that type of movie. And Boyhood is definitely one of those types of movies that I may never watch again, but I know I will think about probably at least every 6 months or so for the rest of my life.
Okay. You got anything else?
Nope. Okay. Ethan Hawke for president?
Yeah. When's the Ethan Hawke cast coming?
I mean, this is our first one. This is the first movie we talked about that features Ethan Hawke in a prominent role. Don't think I wasn't aware of that. You know, I had a lot of pro Ethan Hawke sentiments that I've been holding on for years.
And you did do an article about the Before series. And so there's a lot of Ethan Hawke love if anyone's listening and wants to hear more of Alex going on about Ethan Hawke.
I've actually since removed that from the site. So,
And this section from the podcast, moving on.
Because we all can grow and we all can change, you know, and our opinions change with time. General rule about Ethan Hawke, the more himself he is playing, the better of an actor he is. That's why he's really great in all of Linklater's movies. We don't know what we'll be talking about for our next episode, but be sure to check back themcguffman.com and follow us on Twitter at themcguffman. Thanks for listening.
Thanks for listening to The MacGuffin Men. Be sure to check out themcguffinmen.com for supplementary links, articles, and more. Thanks for listening.